Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, and may it please the court. I'm Veronica Rossman with the Federal Public Defender on behalf of Mr. Bacon. This appeal challenges the district court's decision to keep Mr. Bacon's plea supplement filed under seal over his objection. The principal error, the principal reversible error in this case, is the manner in which the district court decided the sealing issue. And
Let me interrupt you for a minute, because one thing that I find a little frustrating about this case is looking at the district court record, no one ever asked Judge Neufer to unseal that record. They asked him to strike it. And the test is different for striking or unsealing. And there was never any argument to Judge Neufer that this was a sealing issue that brought in the common law presumption. And so how do you respond to that?
Well, Your Honor, the request in the district court was to remove the sealed supplement. One way of understanding that certainly is a request to strike. But really, the substance of the request here was that the presence of the sealed document caused Mr. Bacon a couple of problems. One was the presence of the sealing itself. So striking it from the docket would remove the word sealed, presumably. But also, because the document was sealed, Mr. Bacon could not access it or use the information in it to disclose the truth about his non-cooperation. So it certainly could have been framed as more explicitly as a request to unseal or more explicitly as a request to strike. What it was presented to the court as a request to remove the sealed supplement.
Well, there was a motion to strike in the district court.
There was a motion to remove the sealed supplement. That's essentially, and I think that it is a semantic distinction, because really I think what this court is getting at is the preservation question, that if we didn't utter the words common law right of access in the district court, is the issue preserved? And if the court finds that the issue is not preserved, we think that there are several reasons to find that it is preserved here, the two being that Mr. Bacon made a request of the district court. The district court denied his request. That is the subject of this appeal. So it's not like a brand new issue.
But we're at plain error here, aren't we? I mean, all of these arguments now that have been made in the briefing pertain to presumptions of openness to judicial documents. And those arguments were not made before Judge Neufer.
That's correct, Judge Risco. Those arguments were not made. And if this court is inclined to review for plain error, it should, because we satisfy the requirements for plain error. And I'd like to say, to start, that plain error is properly invoked in this case as an appellate matter as well. We assumed in the opening brief in good faith that we had a reason to think that the issue was preserved. After the government challenged preservation, we made an argument for plain error in our reply brief. And this was a permissible approach to preserving the issue under this court's jurisprudence, particularly United States versus Zander.
Back to Judge McHugh's question. Did the district court treat this as a motion to strike or a motion to seal? What was the district court's response to the request?
Well, the district court's response was to not remove the sealed supplement from the docket.
But in its ruling, wasn't its discussion geared to and looking at sealing?
It was. We know that it was, because the rule that it relied on, the only law that it relied on to make the decision about whether or not to remove the sealed supplement, was the rule in the District of Utah, Local Rule 11-1, which provides for categorical sealing without any sort of individualized case-by-case analysis. And that's the only thing that the court relied on in this case to make the decision.
And if we were at a motion to strike versus a motion to seal, either issue would be abuse of discretion standard of review? Or is there a difference? Does this matter?
We don't think the standard of review is dispositive, because the law is well settled here. But the standard of review for making a decision about whether to seal or strike is an abuse of discretion standard.
Okay.
But implicit within that is, if there's a legal mistake, if the court uses the wrong legal standard, then the review is de novo. So that's why there's sort of a bit of a conflation when it comes to what the standard is. We do satisfy all four elements of plain error here. The error is that the court resolved the sealing issue by relying solely on its local rule without reference to the balancing inquiry required under the common law right of access doctrine. It assumed that local rule 11-1 was the only source of law that applied, that it automatically required sealing, and there was no case-specific analysis done in this case. Indeed, the district court's adjudication of the issue referenced the opposite of case-specific facts. Issues of inmate violence, a presentation that the judge had attended, some compelling information. There was no specificity as applied to this case. The error is plain under well-settled law. The common law right of access to judicial records is well-settled in the Supreme Court and in this court. Particularly, we rely on the Nixon decision for setting that standard. And I would refer your honors to, this is an unpublished case, but Judge Briscoe and Judge McHugh, you were on the panel of United States versus Walker. We're not relying on that case for preservation. It's not so good for us for preservation, but the discussion of the legal principles is the most robust discussion that I've seen recently of this court that cites all of the applicable cases.
Pertaining to what?
Pertaining to the presumption of access.
Presumption?
Okay. Yes, the common law right of access. Certainly, the common law right of access is not an absolute right. The interest can be overcome when there are countervailing interests that heavily outweigh the presumption.
Who has this common law right? I mean, I was struck by the Nixon citation, as I often am. The right there that was being pursued was really a right of the public, the right of the public to know. And here we're talking about an individual. Does the individual take on the cloak of the public here?
Well, in our briefs,
it almost feels like a standing thing sometimes when I think
It does. It does. Although the way I think the court should understand it is it's an interest balancing analysis. Mr. Bacon invoked his request to remove the sealed supplement from the docket invoked the district court's obligation to consider the issue under the presumption of access rules, which require a balancing test. So the balancing is a balancing of interests. On one side, you have the presumptive right of the public to access judicial records. On the other side, you have the government's interest, and here the government's interest, it asserts, is in the integrity of the local rules and in protecting cooperators. And certainly the interest in cooperator safety that the government advances is premised on this idea of treating all dockets the same, and that idea falls apart when not all dockets are treated the same and there's no national uniformity.
An attempt at that, the CACM committee, as we like to call them.
The CACM committee,
yeah.
Yes.
they are trying to make this a uniform policy across the country.
Well, that's no longer the case. They experimented with it. It was experimented with and discussed and vetted.
Yeah.
With the eye toward making a national, federal rule on this. And that was rejected. And the reason why, one of the reasons why, was it's going to raise constitutional and common law right of access problems. And so the notion that the government's interest in cooperator safety, standing here as a federal defender, I certainly appreciate the laudable goal of protecting cooperators. But the value of judicial transparency should not be sacrificed for a goal whose achievability is dubious in the universe that we live in. And so, Judge Briscoe, getting back to your point about where does Mr. Bacon's interests fall, he is a party, but his interests are relevant to the balancing inquiry here.
Let me interject. When looking at whether this error was plain, we have a rule that was adopted through congressional authority. And we have other instances where, for example, Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 41.1A says that you redact certain information that identifies people. We redact child victims' names, victims of sexual assault. In quitam actions, we file them under seal for a period of time. I mean, there are all kinds of rules that don't do a case-by-case balancing that we routinely allow to violate the common law rule of access, public access. And it seems to me that where we have a rule, in order for you to show that this error was plain, you need more than the common right of access, because it does yield to interests that are more global sometimes.
I understand your point, Judge McHugh, but there are material differences here. The examples that you cite are federal rules that are uniform, that have gone through a committee process of notice and comment, that are nationally implemented. And here we have a local rule where one judicial district has decided to essentially employ a docket disguise practice and treat the information about cooperation in a way that preferences the interests of cooperators by giving misleading information about non-cooperators. So the rules that you identify, Your Honor, are federal rules. They're not local rules. Moreover,
well,
even
some of them are local. The government cites the Eastern District of Virginia, and that they seal all Social Security actions. I mean, that's not national federal rule. It's a local.
But that local rule seems to be consistent with the national rule. Here, there is no national rule by which to assess the local rule. There's no national benchmark. And the reason why there's no national benchmark is because the CACM committee concluded that creating a federal rule in this area would create constitutional and federal common law right of access problems. Just one more point in response to your question, Your Honor, and that is that even in the situations where you just have identified where the presumption is secrecy, not openness, you still can address to the court in its discretion a case-by-case argument for perhaps not invoking that rule in that particular case. So even there's room to yield to a case-by-case analysis. Our point here is that the presumption with respect to these judicial records that are at issue is openness.
On the plain error, I'm trying to get your sort of the points you've made on plain error. One is you're suggesting that the fact that there's a local rule doesn't help here any, because it's not controlling on a national level, and the other is that the context doesn't matter. The fact that this is an individual essentially asserting public rights also doesn't matter in the plain error analysis.
That's correct.
Can you point to any case law, though, in terms of what, you know, that we could look to that supports you? And I understand you're pointing
right
to the fact that
I can't.
The presumption is the opposite.
Certainly. I can't point to any fact-specific cases, but I don't think that I need to, because this isn't a very nuanced area of the law. This is a judicial record that should be presumptively open. In fact, it is, where there is in play a blanket sealing policy in a local district, which is very different from how sealing decisions are made. They're supposed to be case-by-case, individualized, not permanent. They have a very sort of temporary, case-specific quality to them. And Your Honors, I'd like to save the remainder of my time, but just very briefly, we do satisfy the third and fourth prongs here, and the only good thing about plain error in this case is that it highlights the fourth prong, that openness is truly one of the cornerstones of the American judicial system, that this court's job is not to take a position on should we protect cooperators, should we not. It's to take a view on the rule of law, and the rule of law in this case is the presumption of openness.
And I want to challenge you for a minute on the third prong, because if we did the balancing on your client now, you've got the sealed record that they can't get to, but you now have a docket full of motions from your client to open that record, and in those documents that are public indicating he did not cooperate. Would that change the balance here?
It would not, Your Honor, because there is this also sort of relates to perhaps questions of standing or mootness. Under the third prong, he needs to show a reasonable probability that but for the error claimed, the result of the proceeding would be different. The fact that there's all of this stuff in the open now doesn't undermine justiciability in any way, and the fact that all of this stuff is in the open now is actually an animating reason. It's a reason to support access. It's a reason that undermines the government's interest in secrecy. That's how the court should understand it. It's one of the factors that in this case undermines the interest in secrecy.
So if you prevail here, what would you like to see occur? Remand to the district court for revisiting this issue?
That's right, Your Honor. Okay. May I finish my answer? I'm running out here.
Yeah, you okay. are out.
May I finish?
Go ahead.
Okay. What we would like to see happen is for this court to remand to the district court for further proceedings so that the court can assess the sealing question under the correct legal standard.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Ryan Tenney. I'm Ryan Tenney, and I'm here on behalf of the United States. In light of the question, let me just start with the case-specific analysis question. That seems to be one of the two central questions of this appeal. We've cited those various rules and statutes in our brief in which Congress and the Rules Committee have set aside certain kinds of information and said that they're going to be categorically sealed or redacted. And I think the importance of that list, and there could have been more, but I think the importance of that list is this. It's a recognition of those rulemakers. It's a recognition by those rulemakers that there are certain kinds of information that are so categorically sensitive that we're not going to require an individual district court to engage in a case-specific analysis before ordering them to be sealed. Just use any of those examples. If a party in a criminal case files a motion or a pleading that includes a minor victim's name, do we really want the district court having to engage in a case-specific analysis before ordering that name to be redacted?
If that's what the law requires, yes.
Right, and that's really our point, is there's this sort of, on a macro level, there's this recognition that there are some kinds of information that we're just going to say, seal this, and you don't have to engage in a case-specific analysis as the district court.
But are we talking there about federal rules, or are we talking about local rules? Here we're talking about a local rule.
That's true. And so then the question would be
and
whether...
there's a difference, isn't there? Huge difference.
I think there's a difference. I'd push back a little bit on the huge part of it. I think there is a difference, but I don't think it's a difference that matters here. And the reason it doesn't matter here is there's two reasons. One, the local districts are specifically empowered by Congress to make rules regarding the practice before their courts. This
a
is
rule
not,
that applies a presumption of closure, which is contrary to the law?
We don't think it is contrary to law. I mean, if you get to the, that's sort of the second question, which is whether this is justifiable under the test, we think it's very justifiable under the law. The test is set forth in a number of cases is whether the interests favoring closure outweigh or heavily outweigh the interests of the public in access to the information.
And but doesn't that require a case-by-case determination? And we don't have that here. We have the district court saying, you know, this is a good thing for you because the committee has looked at this and we see the general good of this idea, which I appreciate right. those thoughts, but it has nothing to do with this defendant.
Well, this is where the two issues, they become somewhat circular. I mean, the reason that the district court gives here for sealing this information is because of the local rule. And the local rule is justified by concerns that the district court refers to. So long as those concerns are sufficient to satisfy the test, then our view is that the district court can follow that automatic rule.
And so what is the test we're satisfying?
The test, it's originally set forth in Nixon and then it's picked up in the cases, is whether the reasons advanced by the party seeking sealing the information outweigh or heavily outweigh even the interest in the public in accessing the information. And so long as the district court here can point to sufficient justification for sealing this information categorically, then our view is that it can rely on the rule and it doesn't have to engage in a case-specific analysis in every instance. It can just say, this is our rule. It's sufficiently justified. We're going to do this every time.
Well, is it appropriate to look at whether, because it's a local rule and not a national rule, it really can't perform in the way that is hoped, meaning that there is no uniformity on what's done on these sentencing supplements, and so it doesn't necessarily protect cooperators in jail.
Right. It's certainly appropriate to look at it. We just don't think that it's outcome determinative here. It's appropriate to look at it because this is a balancing. And Nixon speaks of it as a balancing. The other cases speak of it as a balancing.
But here the district court didn't look at it. The district court just said, the defendant's trying to make that argument, and the district court said, well, I've got this rule and I'm going to follow the rule.
That is what it said. I think it goes a step beyond that. If you look to that portion of the transcript at the resentencing, the district court specifically refers to the national studies that were underway. It says on the record why it's doing this, why it's following.
He acknowledges the concern of the defendant.
He does.
And the potential harm, potentially. But I'm not sure that's at all a balancing of the interests.
He
still essentially, in the end, refers to the local rules and the presumption of closure.
It does, although there's an interesting word if you look to that passage. One of the things that the court says is that it uses the word change in that passage that we've cited. It's page 18 of that transcript. The court says it's possible to change this rule, but we're not going to because there have been studies. It refers to national studies. So the court is aware that the local district has the authority to perhaps change this rule, but then it refers to the studies as justification for not changing the rule. And so we're back to that question. This gets to your earlier question, Judge Briscoe. Is there sufficient justification for this rule? And the district court here is referring to the national studies. It's referring to, by reference, it's essentially invoking these various concerns that have been identified in the various reports and studies. And this gets to your question, Judge McHugh, and I really wanted to address this because it's part of, I think it's one of the central questions of the balancing here, which is whether this rule can be justified even without a national consensus on it, even without a national rule. And our answer is yes. I would certainly agree that it would be better, it would be more effective if this were adopted nationwide. I mean, the interests in closure in terms of protecting cooperators, they would be more pronounced if this were nationwide. But the question in front of you is not whether this is the best rule. The question in front of you is whether this is permissible. And the way that I've come to think of this as I've prepared this argument is you essentially have something of a spectrum here. On the one end, you could have a system of total transparency. And that would obviously benefit the public good in terms of the transparency interests, but it would do so at the expense of a cooperator system. On the other end, you could have a system of no transparency, and that would harm the public's interest in access, but it would benefit the cooperator system. Or you could have something in between. And the different districts have gone in different directions on this. And so the question in front of you under Mann and Picard and Nixon and all these cases is there an interest here that outweighs the public's interest? And if a district is looking at this and it's saying, you know, we're going to favor this interest over that interest, that's permissible because there's a significant interest in play. Now, as to the nationwide...
But it has to get down to this defendant, doesn't it? This case-by-case requirement. How else do you overcome this presumption? You have to have weighing. You have to have the real facts at issue here.
Right.
And to just put this general gloss, is just trust us, it's good for you because we're doing this nationally and we have a global idea that's a positive idea that protects cooperators.
Right.
I mean, that's not enough, is it?
We think it is enough. I think there's two components to your question. One, none of the cases cited from this court or for the Supreme Court have held that this presumption has to apply even in the face of a binding categorical rule. So if you were to say in this appeal that if a district court is confronted with a binding categorical rule, it doesn't have to engage in a case-by-case analysis.
Is the binding local, this is a local rule.
That's true.
This local rule, it can counter the presumption here?
As long as it's justified. I mean,
back to the loop we speak of, the justification gets back to a case-by-case analysis as regards this defendant.
Right. And so let me address this in terms of the national impact and then work my way down. It's true that it would be better if it were nationwide, but it doesn't have to be nationwide. There's evidence even within this record that shows that even on a case-by-case basis that this is effective on some level. We've cited on page 51 of our brief to the FJC supplemental report. The FJC supplemental report, which was issued in 2016, reported a survey done of district court judges. And that survey, this is the report, quote, "The results suggest that districts adopting steps to protect cooperating information often see lower rates of harm than those that do not. And, quote, districts that adopt a policy," and it's referring to a uniform policy, "see less harm than those that do not." So even if this is just done on a district-by-district basis, there is some evidence that suggests that this has an impact, a positive impact on cooperator safety. And so that would be our starting point on the nationwide question. But then there's another interest which adds on top of that, which is this isn't just a function of cooperator safety versus non-cooperator safety. There's also the systemic component as well, which is that if you create a system that protects cooperators, you're going to make it easier for a person to cooperate, and that's a pronounced public good. The cooperation system has benefits. It helps solve crimes. It helps prevent future crimes, thereby preventing the creation of future crime victims. And so if you have a system that not only protects cooperators, and again, the data suggests that it does, but it also makes it easier for the cooperation system to function effectively. And if you come back to the test, this is really my response to your question, Judge Briscoe, if you come back to the test, which is information can be sealed, even under the cases, it can be sealed if the reasons for doing so outweigh the public interest. And there's evidence here that shows that, one, it protects cooperators, and two, it enables a functioning cooperator system. That's enough. I mean, there are cases that have permitted the sealing of information. Hickey permits the sealing of information. Nixon permits the sealing of information. And so there's enough here for the district court to look at this and say, on this spectrum, here's our solution, and there's reason to think it's effective. And so then this comes back to this question. This is the sort of chicken and egg part of this argument. Can it do it by a uniform rule? And the answer is yes, it can do it by uniform rule, because no Supreme Court case has said that it can't.
Well, is that a plain error argument?
And that would fold into our plain error argument.
So if we disagreed with you and we thought there was error here, your position is any error was not plain?
Yes.
And why not?
Because
we've got Nixon saying case-by-case analysis. We've got Tenth Circuit cases saying case-by-case analysis. Yeah. Why isn't it plain?
Because all of those cases, Nixon, Picard, Apperson, all of those cases involved a motion to seal that was filed within the context of an individual case, and the district court was not bound by a particular rule. None of those cases said that a district court cannot follow or adopt a categorical rule.
So that's the difference. That is it, right?
That is
there.
The difference.
There's a local rule here.
Yeah, there's a local rule.
Is there a Supreme Court case saying that a local rule can overcome in this context?
I'm not aware.
The presumption in favor of opening and keeping the records open?
I'm not aware of a case that's looked
at. Isn't that really what the plain error is then? That there's no case allowing a switch of the presumption to closure by a local rule? So isn't that the error that's plain?
Well, as the appellant, he would have the burden of establishing the plain error. So he would have the burden of establishing mm-hmm. that this is obviously
And he establishes what the presumption is, and he says it's plain error for the courts to adopt a local rule that turns that presumption on its head. There's no authority for that.
Right, except he would have to show that it's obvious that the district court cannot. And then our response there would be, look at the overall landscape of the law. Look at the numbers.
You're basically saying because they did it, it's obvious that they can.
No,
I'm not getting that.
I think I'm saying something a little bit different with respect, Your Honor, which is that if you're assessing obviousness, you're looking at the cases and you're looking at how the systems work. And there's a broad-scale understanding in the law that there are some kinds of information that are categorically sealed, despite the presumption, despite the common law, despite the First Amendment, that whole list of statutes and rules. And so if a district court is looking at this unpreserved objection and is saying, can I do this? Can I enforce this rule? And then it sees this large number of other circumstances in which courts are required to do this sort of thing, the answer would be, it's not obvious that I can't. The other thing that we would point to there is what the Supreme Court did with PSRs. We cited this in our brief. This is the Julian decision. The Supreme Court in Julian flips the presumption, to use your phrase, Judge Moritz, flips the presumption on its head, and it does so by judicial action. It says this kind of information is so categorically sensitive that ordinary presumption is, we're going to reverse it. And the party that wants it to be unsealed has to overcome that. The information...
We don't have a judicial exception here, though. We have a local rule.
Well, except...
That applies in...
Right, but
applied in a blanket fashion.
Sorry. Except that the argument that the defendant is making here is a common law argument. And so he's having to say, he has to convince you, because this is up on plain error, he has to convince you that the common law forbids a district court from adopting and or following a local rule. And our point is, if the Supreme Court has already flipped the presumption by case law, and if Congress and the rulemakers have already recognized a laundry list of circumstances that can also flip the presumption, why would it be obvious that a local district court can't do this too under its congressionally delegated authority, particularly where the reasons for categorically sealing this information are consistent with the reasons for the PSRs being confidential, and particularly where the unique reasons for sealing this information almost depend on the intra-district uniformity. I mean, this is really a unique circumstance because the system sort of rises or falls based on it being followed uniformly within the district. And so...
Well, and that's only one district, and there are many in these United States. Mm-hmm. I mean, we do not have uniformity across the nation on this issue. And as you know, the bus pulls up to the penitentiary every morning and moves people out to different penitentiaries all across the country. So what happens in this district, really, I mean, there's a lot of other districts at play, and for uniformity to matter, it has to be literally uniform, absolutely, and it's not.
My red light just came on. Can I respond to that?
Yes, please.
Okay. We'd again refer back to the FJC supplemental memorandum, which specifically says that even on a district-by-district basis, the districts that have adopted a uniform policy are seeing better results. Mm-hmm, the other thing that we'd refer to is that Utah's not alone in this, 15 other districts and that list that we've put forward. But really, there's sort of an experimentation component to this, where there's nothing in the common law. Again, that's the question. Does the common law say that Utah cannot do this? And as long as there's reason to think that this is going to help, and there is, then we think that the common law doesn't forbid this.
Thank you. Thank you for your argument this morning. Thank you both.